And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
There are a couple of podcasts I've never done. And before the end of the year, I hope to do them both. And today, I am going to do one of those, and that is a podcast that is basically a review of a book. Now, I have for years recommended the Little Book of Common Sense Investing by John Bogle, and Your Money and Your Brain by Jason Zweig, and the Mutual Funds for Dummies, and of course, Financial Fitness Forever. But there's a new book on the market that I am really excited about, because it addresses both some of the challenges about how to put together a portfolio, but my sense is the work that I do is probably pretty good in that area, as good as I know to make it. But Jonathan Clements, in his new book, How to Think About Money, combines both those decisions about how to build a portfolio with some very major decisions about how we view money, in our life during the different stages of our life. And he even addresses some things. Well, I'll get to it. I'll get to it in a few minutes. But I'm going to go through this book. I'm going to actually read parts of it, I think are very good, and highlight some of the lessons, just a few of the lessons. I teased you and I said 10 lessons or 10 things you must know, but I suspect there probably are 100 great lessons in this book. Now, Jonathan Clements, I met very early in my career as an investment advisor back in the 80s. He was at that time writing for the Wall Street Journal. He is a graduate from Cambridge University. He was born in England. He has written not only for the Wall Street Journal, but for Euromoney and Forbes. And for 6 years, he was the director of financial education for Citigroup, the bank's U.S. wealth management business. So he knows investing, and I think he's straight up. I've never sensed a conflict of interest. I've never sensed when I've read his work that he was telling half of the story. I feel the same way about Jason Zweig. I feel the same way about George Sisti and Larry Swedrow. I mean, there are a number of people who I have a high degree of trust in, and so I hope that you will read How to Think About Money. It's a paperback, it's inexpensive, and it's a short read. I think it's 140 pages, but it's valuable. Now, you can just turn this off and go buy it, and you can read it, and I think you'll discover the things that I'm about to spend, I don't know, could be a half an hour going through to tell you why I like this book and the lessons that caught my attention. So if you want to save a half an hour, buy the book. On the other hand, let me, for those of you who want to stick around and see what I liked about it, I'll highlight some of the things. And it starts with the foreword by William Bernstein. Now, William Bernstein has written some terrific books about investing. I want to say the Four Pillars of Investment Success. I think that's the title. I'm embarrassed not to know for sure, but I believe that's close. But he believes in the kinds of things that I do. That doesn't necessarily make him a great advisor. Maybe I believe what he believes, and maybe he's the leader of the pack, but he's been doing this for certainly as long as I have, William Bernstein has. But in his foreword, he says a couple things that I think are special. One is he does share a comment from his sainted mother. She said, "Money doesn't buy happiness, but at least you can suffer in comfort." I like that. But let me give you, and I have this book all marked up, but let me just give you a few words here. Point number seven out of nine that he developed in the introduction. He said, the name of the game isn't to get rich, it's to not die poor. The quickest way to get filthy rich, of course, is to win the lottery, but if your investment strategy revolves around lottery tickets, you'll almost certainly die poor. The investment equivalent of the lottery ticket is looking for the next Apple or Starbucks, and your odds of succeeding are about the same as with a lottery ticket. Now, to you young investors, That is extremely important piece of information, because for some reason, young investors just love the idea of looking for the investment that is likely to break the bank. Unfortunately, probably more people are broken by those investments or speculations than break the bank. And second thing I liked a lot, number nine, he talks about the most important financial asset we bequeath to our kids is their unconscious adoption of our spending habits. Not our investing habits, our spending habits. Because probably the number one key to long-term investing is the ability to save, smart saving, or we could call it smart spending, is step number one. So, and there's a lot more in that introduction, but that'll give you a sense. Then we go into these five, there are five chapters. Step number one is basically chapter number one in terms of what he wants you to know. And I go through to page 17, where I face a whole list of comments about how money works, what it means to your life. He says, money can buy happiness, but not nearly as much as we imagine. Number two, we place too high a value on possessions and not enough on experiences. Number three, spending money on others can deliver greater happiness than spending it on ourselves. And by the way, he develops this throughout the book. These little bullets give you a feel, but it all gets discussed in the book beautifully. Number four, we are often happier when we have less choice, not more. And I found that part of the book, when he discusses that, very valuable. Number five, working hard toward our goals can bring great pleasure, but achieving our goals is often a letdown. Again, it's a fascinating part of this book as it pertains to kind of the psychological aspects. There's a little bit in this book that reminds me of the work that Jason Zweig developed in his Your Money and Your Brain. And here's a paragraph under step number one. A 2006 Pew Research Center study found that Republicans were happier than Democrats, and churchgoers were happier than those who stayed home on Sundays. The study also found that those with and without pets and those with and without children were equally happy. I think most of us probably think that because we love our kids, we loved raising them, and oh, the frustrations of that process. But as we look back, we think of the good things, and we make decisions about how other people are likely to be happy. In fact, we may even try to influence our children to make decisions that in fact may not make them happier, whether it's about family, whether it's about money, whatever. And here's another paragraph from this chapter. In 2014, 32.5% of Americans said they were very happy versus a 42-year average of 33.3%. The survey, by the way, this is going back over 42 years, And actually, the Americans were saying they're kind of less happy today than they were some years ago. The survey also found that 27% were satisfied with their financial situation, compared in 42 years ago by 29.6%. Over the intervening four decades, U.S. inflation-adjusted disposable income per capita grew 108%. The great conundrum: we have twice as much to spend as we had 42 years ago, but our reported level of happiness is no higher, and our satisfaction with our financial situation has declined. You know, maybe we've seen some of that, certainly, in the latest election. Let me add here. Adaptation may also explain why we are often happier if we have less choice. I think we'd probably consider having more choices as making us happier, but he says maybe not. The freedom to choose is much valued in American society, but it also breeds uncertainty. And uncertainty can be the death of happiness. If we don't like where we live, but we can't afford to move, we adapt. But if we have enough money to move tomorrow, we might never adapt and instead wrestle with the decision every day, trying to figure out whether we should stay put or buy a home somewhere else. Happiness lies not in the choice, but in making a decision and eliminating the choice. Now, that was a thought I'd not had before, but I think it makes a lot of sense. Happiness lies not in the choice, but in making a decision and eliminating the choice. I think that's a sage comment. It's one of the reasons I like the work that that Jonathan does. Another paragraph from that chapter: we get greater happiness if we spend money on others rather than on ourselves. We will likely get more pleasure from frequent small purchases than occasional big expenditures. We also get more pleasure if we delay purchases rather than buying items right away, because the delay brings with it an enjoyable stretch of anticipation. And I'll tell you why I think this is important. And I'm speaking very specifically to young investors in their 20s. We want so much so soon, and yet there's a price to pay for that, I think. And to the extent that we could figure out how to do smaller purchases rather than the big ones, whether we could enjoy the process of delayed gratification instead of having it in our house immediately, where it is oftentimes immediately, almost immediately, forgotten. Because one of the challenges young people have is the ability to save. And if you get this part right about putting our feelings into perspective about that spending of money, maybe we will, in fact, be a better saver. So those are my comments out of the chapter one, or step number one. Step number two, the chapter title is Bet on a Long Life. Most of us will enjoy extraordinarily long lives, and that has profound financial implications. And this is a big deal, because there is a tendency for people to bet on the short term rather than the long term. And if we don't, in fact, take care of the long term, that would be a terrible decision. So let me read a little bit out of step number two, talking about how long we live or might live. How long? If you were a man born in the U.S. in 1900, your life expectancy at birth was age 52. If you were a woman, it was age 58. By 2000, life expectancy at birth had climbed roughly 50% to age 480 for a man and to age 84 for women. Impressed? For those hoping to live to a ripe old age, there's good news and bad news. The bad news? While male life expectancy climbed 28 years during the 20th century and female life expectancy rose 26 years, a large part of the increase was due to falling infant mortality rather than rising life expectancies for those who made it to adulthood. Moreover, the bulk of the improvement in life expectancy, 20 years in the case of both men and women, occurred during the first half of the 20th century. And I found that interesting. It was something that I was not aware of. I'm certainly not an expert on life expectancy. But I had this feeling that the reason we were living longer was simply because we made these medical breakthroughs that helped us do that. But a large part evidently came from life expectancy due to the better, lower infant mortality. Among those born in 1951, Jonathan says, who are still alive today, the life expectancy is age 84 for men and 87 for women. Keep in mind that these are medians, which means half of all folks will live to these ages or longer. Among today's 65-year-olds, roughly 25% will live to at least age 90, and 10% to at least age 95. Now, I will just add to that that actuarially, a couple at age 65 who are in good health, there's a 25% likelihood that one of them will be alive at 97, and there's a 50% likelihood that one of them will be alive at 92. Here's some more from Jonathan on this, how long we live and the likelihood that we are going to have the people to support us, to take care of us as we live to whatever age we make. And it says in 2005, we had 4.8 adults aged 20 to 64 for every person age 65 or older. Today, the ratio is 3.9 to 1, and by 2030, it will be down to 2.7 to 1. You and I may be able to save like crazy so we can still retire at age 65, he says, but as the population of senior citizens grows ever larger, not everybody can quit the workforce at 65. Those still working simply couldn't produce enough goods and services to meet the needs of the entire population. One day or another, we need the retirement age to climb. That might be driven by, and I think this is interesting, lower investment returns, rising inflation, or cuts in Social Security, or some combination of these and other factors that put financial pressure on older Americans and prod them to stay in the workforce for longer. Now, I have read that surveys suggest that the new retirement age for people who are being born today will be 80. Well, Jonathan asks, what does all this mean for how to handle your money? I would argue that today's impressive life expectancy has four key financial implications. First, we need to get ourselves on the right financial track as early in our adult life as possible. Amen, I say. So we quickly achieve some measure of financial freedom. Second, we should use that freedom to focus on work we're passionate about. Third, we should invest for the long term, and that means making a lifetime lifetime commitment to stocks. Finally, when managing money, we should worry less about dying young and more about living an astonishing long life. In the pages ahead, we'll tackle each of those four notions. Important point. We should focus on the fact that we are likely to live a long time and that we are going to need to have a lot of money to support us, more than likely a lot of money to support us in a lifestyle that we would approve of today. But if we focus too much on today, and if we find out that we don't get the kinds of returns that we expect, if we find out that we don't have enough stocks in our portfolio, because that's where the growth is in stocks. There are surveys out about the millennials and how little money they're putting into stocks, that so much of their portfolio is going into bonds. That could be a mistake, truly catastrophic mistake. Let me go forward here to page 50. Bear with me for just a second. And he says, talking about the question about stocks and how much sense it makes to buy stocks. And I think he puts this in an interesting kind of a novel way. He said, should you also buy stocks? After talking about the real estate and tying up money in real estate for the long term. He says, most people believe that it makes more sense to buy a home than to rent, because homeowners gradually come to own a valuable asset outright as they pay down their mortgage. Similarly, given a choice, most people would probably prefer to be an owner of a business rather than just an employee, because the owner has greater autonomy and makes more money. He goes on to say the same logic applies when investing. We could lend money, which is what we do when we open a savings account, buy bonds, or purchase certificates of deposit. We allow others the use of our money, for which they pay us interest. And of course, he's saying that you're much better. He says, we should become an owner by buying a globally diversified portfolio of stocks. Those are my comments out of step number two. By the way, he also, in that chapter, talks a lot about the Social Security decision and the use of annuities. I think many of you that are coming up on making that decision about whether to take Social Security now or later would be paid huge potential dividends by reading that chapter. Step number three is entitled, Rewire Your Brain. We are hardwired for financial failure, so sensible money management takes great mental strength. So in this chapter, and here we get into some of that material that we have covered before in reading the Jason Zweig's Your Money and Your Brain, but let me just quickly, if I might, just hit the bullet points that he goes into some nice information about each of these challenges we have. He says we're too focused on the short term. We lack self-control. We believe the secret to investment success is hard work. By the way, those are all real challenges, I think, for investors. He says we think the future is predictable. We see patterns where none exists. We hate losing. We've talked about that many times, haven't we? That people are so afraid of losing that they don't take the opportunity of accepting that loss. And along with that, historically, have come tremendous gains. He says we're overconfident. He adds, we take credit for our winners while blaming our losers on others. And I can tell you, for the couple of years I was a stockbroker, I found that so true. If I recommended something for people to invest in, they commonly, and it worked, they commonly took credit for that investment. On the other hand, if I recommended something that didn't go up, it went down instead, guess who the goat was? Yes, I was. He says, our risk tolerance isn't stable. He says we rationalize bad decisions. We favor familiar investments. That's why a lot of people, by the way, put all their money in their 401k in their company. In fact, I think it's amazing that people who put money in their own company thinks that that is less risky than having their money in the S&P 500. He adds, we put a higher value on investments we already own. And we prefer sins of omission to sins of commission. Important point. Let me just add some of what he says here. If we fail to sell a stock and the shares subsequently fall in price, we might kick ourselves. But our sense of regret will likely be less than if we did go ahead and sell, and soon after the shares skyrocket in value. This fear that our actions may make matters worse is sometimes referred to as status quo bias. The devil I know is better than the devil I don't know. Here's another one. We find stories more convincing than statistics. We like the sizzle, not the steak. We love stories. And salespeople learn how to tell stories. They go to school to learn how to tell stories. They even learn, and I remember this from my training back in the 60s when I was in New York, and they had a list of words that give people a sense of optimism and greed, and a list of words you never want to use because they create feelings of fear and the likelihood that they won't do what you would like them to do. And we latch onto information that confirms what we already believe. That is a bias that is very expensive, or can be. It may serve you well in the political arena that you look for the facts that justify what you already believe, because it's too hard to live with the idea that somebody else in a different party actually has a good idea from time to time. Now, we like to think of all the reasons they don't. But when it comes to your money, and that's a lot of your life. You see, that vote that you cast, while it's important, is not a life changer. On the other hand, when you have that same problem of looking for something that confirms what you already believe, that could in fact be the exact reason that your investment ship will be sunk. Number 22, I'm not covering all 22, but I note this is number 22. He talks about how we are influenced by how issues are framed. Over the past 50 years, if you said it this way, how gains and losses are framed, he says, we might be told that over the past 50 years, stocks have made money at 75%. Of all calendar years. Now, doesn't that sound like something you want to be part of? Alternatively, he says, we might be told that over the past 50 years, stocks have lost money in 25% of all calendar years. Whoa. You know, both those sentences tell us the same thing. But the one sounds like something I want to be part of. The other, I'm not so sure I want to be part of. Hang on one second. I'm going to page 82. He talks about rich people and how they live. We have pictures of how rich people live. Millionaires. In fact, it's a big deal. People today, people when I was came into the industry back in the 60s, their goal financially was someday to be a millionaire. Today, I talk to young people, their goal is to someday be a millionaire. It's a lot easier to be a millionaire today if you don't screw things up for a whole bunch of reasons, but one is because inflation has made money cheaper and cheaper. You need a lot more than $1 million if you want to replicate what those people were dreaming of back in the 60s. But he talks in here about the studies that have been done regarding the millionaires. 70% never owned a boat. 64% never owned a vacation home. The most popular car based on the latest purchase when this book was written in 2009 is a Toyota. The median price paid for dinner at the restaurant they frequent most often, $20. And I love this one. The median price paid for a man's haircut, $16. And another one that you might enjoy if you are a wine drinker, the median price paid for a bottle of wine when having guests to their home, $13.49. Another point he makes in this step, this chapter, many Americans would love to save more, I suspect, but they simply can't because they have boxed themselves in with high fixed living costs. And then he gives one of his many specific words of advice. He says, my advice, aim to keep your total fixed costs below 50% of your pre-tax income. Now that is an interesting challenge. But if you're going to have any hope of saving the amount of money you probably need to save, that's probably what you're going to have, you will have to live on. He says, talks about some things that are important to the decision-making process about money. He talks in here about people who like to spend and people who are frugal. He says, by being frugal early in our adult life, we will enjoy the pleasure of a gradually rising standard of living. Now, he develops this idea in this chapter, and I think it's a fascinating one because I feel maybe I too, early in my career, wanted too much too fast. And it takes some of the fun out of finally, you know, from saving and instead of taking on a lot of debt and buying something later, you know, you get too much too early, and maybe it's difficult to be satisfied. So those are the points out of step number three I thought you would find interesting. As I said, throughout this book, there are 100, maybe 200 important things that you should know about investing. Now we're on to step number four. Think really, really big. We need to bring order to our financial life by focusing on our paycheck. Now, this is a chapter not everybody is going to agree with. But it does include an interesting discussion about what should be our focus in life. How important is it to do something we absolutely love versus doing something that we might be paid a lot more money for, and for having taken that job we're paid more money for, even though there was something else we would rather do, we save more. And by saving more, maybe we retire at an earlier age, and it is then that we follow our bliss and do something that is really feels rewarding. I think in a sense that I feel some of that myself, because here I am in retirement and having enough that I can do what I did before and got paid for it. But now I can do it for nothing because I saved aggressively. So in step number four, I want to talk here on page 98. I want to take some bullet points and quickly read them. I think they're important. One is young parents will buy, but by the way, he's trying to get people to understand how some of those decisions they make about how they apply the money that they do have are maybe misdirected. He says young parents will buy auto policies with low $250 deductibles, but not bother with life insurance. These couples are taking minimal risk with their minivan and massive risk if they go under the next bus. That's an important decision, how to balance that, how much risk you're willing to take. Another one, folks will carry credit card balances costing 20% while parking cash in a savings account earning 0.1%. I've seen that over the years. Every time I see it, it's just like the old fingernail down the chalkboard. Here's another bullet point. Employees will work for 30 years at a job they hate to qualify for a traditional defined benefit pension. But they wouldn't dream of delaying Social Security benefits by a few years to get a larger monthly check. He says, we see the same phenomenon with immediate fixed annuities. Many retirees would love to have a traditional pension plan, and yet they balk at using their savings to buy an immediate fixed annuity that pays lifetime income, which would give them a comparable stream of income. It's one of the most interesting things about the financial plan, how people would love to have the old-fashioned pension plan. They can have that. They can buy it. Now, my job on educating people for those who decide they don't want to use the stock in the bond market, but they want to have a big position in a pension plan by buying an immediate life annuity, they've got to make sure they buy it right. That's why I'm a great fan of Vanguard for immediate life annuities, USAA, and for people who want a real education, I'm talking about tons of great educational material. Get a hold of Stan the Annuity Man. Here's another irrational thing. Couples will buy lottery tickets and take vacations in Vegas, even as they steer clear of stocks because they're afraid of losing money. I've always been fascinated, too, personally, by people who do some very risky things in their life, including cliff diving, who refuse to take any risk with their portfolio because they might lose money. Here's another bullet point. People will load up on canned goods whenever there's a two-for-one special at the grocery store while failing to stash enough in their employer's retirement plan to get the company's full dollar-for-dollar matching contribution. In a sense, they're both free money. Bullet point. Folks will run screaming with excitement to the shopping mall whenever there's a 50% off sale, but they will run screaming with terror from the stock market whenever there's a 50% off sale. State of mind, fascinating stuff. By the way, you can see how this book could be very important to a young investor, to think through the emotional aspect of this process. Let me go forward to page 111. We're getting there. We're getting there. You're almost done with me. 111. He says, we also need to be careful not to borrow too much. The size of our mortgage and the amount of student debt we take on should be guided by our likely earnings. According to the so-called debt ratio that is used by many banks. Those with mortgages should limit their total monthly debt payments to 36% of pre-tax income. That means someone earning $5,000 a month shouldn't be putting more than $1,800 toward car loans, minimum credit card payments, student loans, and mortgage payments, including property taxes and homeowners insurance. Now, he has, again, I'm certainly not reading all of them, all sorts of kind of basic rules that people, young people, should be considering. Well, all people should be considering in terms of how much you should save, how much you should spend on different expenses. And one last item in this chapter. He says, as I suggested in Chapter 3, good saving habits are the key to financial success. If there's any financial skill we should endeavor to teach our children, it's the ability to delay gratification. By the way, an aside, I have read a lot about this whole delaying gratification. And sometimes people think, well, this is a genetic thing. People are born with the ability to delay or not. And it is fairly well documented that it can be taught. But here's what he goes on to say. This isn't just about encouraging our kids to save up their pocket money for larger purchases. When we tell our children that they can't play until after they have practiced piano, or they can't have candy until after they have had lunch, we are teaching them to delay gratification. Regularly discussing financial issues can also help. But more important is the example we set and the family stories we tell. We should talk to our children about how we scrimped and saved in our 20s, so they'll be prepared to scrimp and save when they get into the workforce. I think that advice is so right on. I did not have parents that taught me that. I think where I got it was from older people than my parents, actually, who had gone, lived through the Depression as an adult and talked about the importance of saving. And they were scary stories. People that had lots of money and all of a sudden found themselves totally broke. And what they had to do to survive, those stories they told me, they made a big impact on me. And when I went into adulthood, I became one of those kind of super savers, I guess. And now step number 5. This chapter is called To Win, Don't Lose. If we want to add to our wealth, we should minimize the subtractions. Does this not sound a lot like Warren Buffett when he says, you know, rule number 1 is don't lose, rule number 2 is don't forget rule number 1. This is a rule or an approach or a belief that almost everybody that I know who's been a success has used. Now, a few people I know have had success. I remember the lady who, and I've written about this and talked about this in the past, the lady who got really rich putting $10,000 into Microsoft when it first went public. And by the way, that was a huge investment for her. But she thought they were such nice-looking boys, and she drove past their office on the way to work and home every day. So she had this emotional bond with them, which made her write a check for $10,000. Turned out to work. It doesn't work to many people. Here are a few pieces out of step number 5. What is financial success? Some of us might get a warm glow from amassing more money than our brother-in-law, beating the S&P 500 index, or having the best toys in the neighborhood. But those are just bragging rights that we can slip away, that can slip away as quickly as they're acquired. The goal isn't to get rich. The goal is to have enough money to lead the life we want. And that is why when I ask people in workshops, what is your primary goal? Is it to beat the market? Is it to find the highest return you can get within your risk tolerance? Or is it to find the lowest risk way to achieve the return that you need? And it is amazing to me that by the time we get fairly close to retirement, we start thinking about having enough to meet our needs. Going to page 122, short one here. There are two ways that wealth dies. It can die slowly, and it can die quickly. Let's start with the slow death. What I think of as the death by a thousand cuts. A classic example is the most almost silent subtraction from our wealth caused by investment costs and taxes. He goes on to say, actively managed funds, the trading costs can cause actively managed funds to realize large capital gains each year, on which taxable shareholders then have to pay taxes. Meanwhile, most index funds generate little or no realized capital gains because they don't actively trade their portfolios. Bogle figures that if an investor made a one-time investment in an index fund and then held it for 40, made a one-time investment in an index fund and then held it for 40 years, the investor would accumulate 175% more wealth after factoring in taxes than an investor who owned an actively managed fund. I like that thought, the death by a thousand cuts. And I talk about those cuts all the time, those defensive steps that you take to lower turnover, to lower taxes, to fight inflation. He says, we are buying a global collection of investments, talking now about the investment in a low-cost index fund. We are buying a global collection of investments with the amount invested in each stock and bond in each country reflecting their market weighting. So we are essentially piggybacking on the collective wisdom of millions of other investors. They have done the hard work of trying to figure out what stocks and bonds are worth and then cast their vote with each buy and sell that they make. By indexing, we benefit from their hard work without incurring any of the costs involved. I think that is a very important point, and along with that, I would note that the academic community has a phenomenal job of creating the information to let us know how to keep from dying from a thousand cuts. And then he talks about dying quickly. He talked about dying slowly, then he talks about dying quickly. I'll just read some headlines. We become disabled and can't work. We load up on our employer's stock in our 401k and they fail. Our spouse, who is the family's main breadwinner, dies suddenly. A booming stock market boosts our self-confidence. We load up on stocks and we get a repeat of the 57% decline of the 2007 through 2009 bear market. And we panic and sell when our stocks are worth half what we paid. We pour our savings into a few rental properties. We have trouble finding tenants and we can't make the mortgage payments and we wind up in foreclosure. This is dying quickly. We don't have health insurance and we get diagnosed with cancer. And finally, we bet everything on one country's stock market. And then maybe like Japan. For 30 years, the market is worth half of what it was at the beginning of that period. Let me also take you, if I might, quickly to the, and he goes into here all about how to build a portfolio, things that I talk about a lot, and there's very little we disagree about, except he might have a little more or less of one asset class or another. And then he has a chapter called Final Thoughts, worth the price of the book, by the way. I don't remember how much this book sells for, but it's a paperback. I think maybe it's $13 or $14, maybe $15. I think he does a beautiful job of talking about our responsibility. I can try to educate you. He can try to educate you. Others can try to educate you. Some are trying to help. Some are trying to hurt. But at the end of the day, these are about your choices. He says there are all kinds of explanations for why we're so poor at handling our finances. We can blame our hardwired instincts, conventional wisdom, Wall Street greed, and corporate America's relentless marketing. But while I can understand why people go astray, my sympathy is in shorter supply. In the end, nobody sticks a gun to our head and forces us to spend too much and buy overpriced investment products. We all still have a choice, and we should be especially careful with our financial decisions because the stakes are so high. Make the wrong choices, and our lives could be dogged by financial worries. Make the right choices, and we could have the financial freedom to lead the life we want. And he finishes the book with 12 suggestions for getting the most out of your money. 1, we favor possessions for their lasting value. But often we get greater happiness when we spend our money on experiences. Forget the new car, he says. Instead, travel across Europe. 2, we should use our dollars to create special times with friends and family. Take the kids to a sports event and your spouse to the theater. Have dinner out with friends. Fly across the country to see the grandchildren. 3, we should design a life for ourselves where we can spend our days doing what we love. To that end, we should save every penny we can early in our adult life so we quickly buy ourselves some financial freedom. 4, we should worry less about dying early in retirement and more about living longer than we ever imagined. 5, our investment time horizon is measured not in months or years, but in decades and decades. We should strive to look beyond the market short-term turmoil and instead aim to collect the staggering gains that can accrue to those who hold diversified stock portfolios for 30 or even 50 years. 6, we should hold down our fixed monthly costs. Remember that 50% he talked about? 7, good saving habits don't come naturally, so we need to make salting money away as painless as possible. And he talks about that a lot in the book. 8, the harder we try to beat the market, the more likely we are to fail thanks to the hefty investment costs we incur. To avoid that fate, we should stop trying to outsmart other investors and instead embrace humility. 9, we should never forget that stocks have fundamental value. And for a diversified stock portfolio, this is still under 9, that fundamental value will change much more slowly than market prices. Number 10, chronologically, retirement might be our life's final financial goal, but we should put it first. Retirement is the most expensive of our goals, and hence we need to save and collect retirement gains for many decades to amass enough money. Number 11, we should take a broad view of our finances, and the unifying notion should be the income from our human capital, or the lack thereof. The paychecks we collect over our lifetime are like a bond that generates 40 years of fairly steady income. And number 12, the goal isn't to get rich. Rather, the goal is to have enough money to lead the life we want. We shouldn't put that at risk by incurring excessive investment costs, straying too far from a global indexing strategy, and failing to buy insurance against major financial risks. So I hope you will share this book, How to Think About Money. I would also enjoy hearing from you. I read a lot of investment books. Everyone will have a lesson. In fact, I make a point of reading Money Magazine every month so I could figure out what you might be seeing and maybe think to warn people when I see something that isn't what I think is right. And if you find this kind of a podcast of interest, let me know. If you think it would be interesting for me to each month to do a relatively brief podcast, maybe half an hour, maybe 45 minutes, about what I learned from the latest Money Magazine, I'd be happy to do that as well. I'm here to make you a better investor, to help you get the right attitude. It is great to have Jonathan Clements on my side here to help you. And in fact, he was kind enough to send me some free books of his so that I might look through them and find more information that's likely to help you become a better investor. Thanks for listening.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.